This is Critical Nonsense, our high-lowbrow show about culture, science, and tech. This week, Joey asks me about tree time bombs.
Woo! Bubble butt. Bubble, bubble, bubble butt. This is what a Joey sounds like. And this is what an executive producer and major laser, Jess Vander, sounds like.
Hi, this is Jess. Major laser? Major laser?
General laser. Emerson likes that song, but it's funny when she tries to sing it because those repeated B's are like just a little bit, require a little bit more dexterity than she is capable of producing. So it winds, it's like bubble, 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 but, you know, instead of like getting that like sort of staccato drum beat. And it doesn't lose its joy every time I hear it.
Yeah, there's a reason that rappers have mastered the art of flow. It is difficult for even the average person to figure that out.
My five-year-old's flow leaves something to be desired. No bars in this house. Jess, we have any housekeeping?
No. Oh, perhaps.
Perchance?
Did we hear back about our recent episode? Why do I think that perhaps we did something about something sports? If I think of it, we'll bring it up.
The sports cheating episode?
Maybe. Well, this is a bust.
We just made it messier.
That was the worst.
Somehow, the house is dirtier.
You know what it's like? It's like when you put on your shoes and then you're like, oh, I forgot something. But it took so long to tie the laces. You're like, no, I'm just going to do it. So you do that tiptoe thing where you're trying to get the least amount of shoe in your... This is maybe like a uniquely New York phenomenon where you like don't want to bring... And also Asian households where you don't want to bring the outside in on your foot.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, how did I just soil the whole...
I will just like run and go get it, but Emerson will totally narc on me.
Oh, of course. Because he knows.
Yeah, because I'm the second tier of family member, so...
Yeah, so flow, piss poor.
Yeah.
But narc...
She's great at being a narc, which is... Everybody loves that. She's going to go places. All right. Jessica, how do you feel about trees?
Well, trees are great.
Love me a good tree.
You know, here's a question, sidebar, on the subject of trees. Have we become less concerned about trees? Like, save the trees? Is that a thing that we equally feel now? Or are we more just like, protect the land? And actually, like, is it a more, has the construct evolved beyond, you know, don't use this paper because you're saving a tree? Like, are we now more confident in our ability to create trees and we're just worried about having enough room for trees to be growing? Does that make any sense?
Yeah, I think broadly speaking, like, the Save the Trees campaign may have worked. Like,
we just saved the trees,
yeah,
y'all.
Like, sustainable... like forest practices seem to be happening, right? Where that's why people are like, okay with using pine in like so many things because people are like replanting
right. On
the back end and it is like a renewable resource and
see,
all that.
Exactly. Because yeah. This is the thing is like where a lot of plastic is being rightfully demonized and it's like, you should use paper instead. And I'm like, oh, so we're definitely cool using paper now.
Yeah. We're good with paper again. All right.
Very
yeah.
Cool about paper. In fact, we're just bemoaning that it makes for horrible straws.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, separate tree-related trivia. I came across something the other day where someone described it as a generationally slow tree time bomb, wherein there was an article about the UK's current situation where about 150 years ago, California redwoods became, more broadly speaking, like giant redwoods, which are sort of sequoias, as well as some Chinese species of redwood, were brought into the country for like a World Fair type of event or like some public showing in crystal palaces, and people were taken by them. And so they, over 500,000 giant redwoods were planted across the country, but they're only just now peeking out above the top of like the local flora. But if they reach their full size, will be like three times taller than the local trees.
Wow.
And in fact, 500,000 redwoods in the UK is like more than there are in California. There's like estimated to be 80,000 in California, now 500,000, which, you know, it's tough to think about something that grows that slowly being an invasive species in the way that maybe we're oriented towards, you know, nutria or lantern flies or things like that, that can have like a rapid, like, deleterious effect on the local environment. But it made me start wondering about these sort of like situations where we're really operating in entirely different timescales, and how we begin to think about that, right? A tree's life is significantly longer than ours. And so, Jess, my question for you is, why should we be concerned with generationally slow time bombs?
Of course, I think of two things right off the bat. One, a conversation I'm sure we've had before, maybe a long time ago, about how we're just generally so horrible about thinking for the long haul. And that, for instance, like, you're much more likely to save money if you like see a picture of your future self, augmented, I'm sure, in some AI capacity now. But the idea that like it's really hard to fathom that much time, even in your own lifespan, let alone beyond your lifespan. And the second thing is that, shockingly, I see your generational tree ticking time bomb and raise you. No, I think it's just the same. I just see you with another
generational. We're surrounded by time bombs.
And it's also tree related. This one being the great Bradford pear mistake.
Oh, no. It is both great and a mistake. Bradford's folly.
It's exactly. It's great in the sense that it has been something that has, especially over the last, I would say, like 5 or 10 years, come up periodically in the news cycle every spring or so in the United States. Because the Bradford pear was once thought to be maybe like the perfect urban planning tree. As the New York Times wrote back in 1964, once about the Bradford pear, few trees possess every desired attribute, but the Bradford ornamental pear comes unusually close to the ideal. And that ideal was that it was super beautiful. Like, it has these nice, pretty flowers. It grows super fast, and a very, very important factor, at least that was thought at the time, was that it was sterile. So that this tree would be planted, it would grow, and then it would just stay as it was, which would be great because it would be easy to manage. It wouldn't produce pollen. It would just be the perfect tree to put on every street, everywhere, in every city, everywhere.
I'm pretty sure my parents' neighborhood has a Bradford pear in front of every house.
That sounds.
I didn't know that that was this tree, but I'm looking at it now and I'm like, I'm pretty sure that's what's in front of my parents' house.
Yeah, totally. If you've seen a Bradford pear, it is sort of the size of a standard maybe oak tree, or you know, one of those bigger trees when it's grown to full scale. It might be smaller at its biggest. It's like 20 to 30 feet.
It's comparable to an apple tree is probably, yeah, like.
That sounds right. And is, you know, like, it's a substantial tree. And so once this was discovered, or, you know, once this idea of like, wow, this is the perfect tree, we're going to put this all over the place. And so it was planted. And then then it turns out this tree is not sterile. And what was happening is that birds were like bringing the pollen from these trees, like, in places that, like, completely random places. And suddenly what was thought to be this perfect tree was an aggressively invasive species that is now taking over, like, so many different parts of North America, let alone just the US, because the Bradford pear is like in the wind. It's like everywhere. Also, there is kind of like, technically this is how it happens. Somewhere along the way, there was like a cross-pollination between variants of the trees and they produce viable fruit. So actually what happens, corrections department, myself, birds and other mammals eat the fruit, poop the seeds, and often that happens really far from where the tree was. That then just has spawned this like horrible question, because now it still grows super fast, and it's just that it's happening in places that people did not expect, and also has this like unfortunate side effect too of like having a not so great fragrance as well when it is blooming. So suffice it, as described as a putrid aroma if emitted at full bloom. And so now here we are yet again of past us not thinking about future us, and all of a sudden the unintended consequences of trees. Ah, how could we be so blind?
Why are we bad at trees? I mean, what I'm learning is that we are bad at trees.
We know this too from fruit and all of the monoculturing of days past. We also know we're bad at trees in a sense of like growing. Ooh, what's the thing I'm thinking of escaping me?
Is it ginkgo trees? Because those stink.
Yeah, well, that is also true. I think maybe just like the general fact that trees are just part of the biome. Like, yeah. There's like stuff that like all the other variables that we did not consider.
Yeah.
You cannot control for all of those things when it's a growing living thing.
Yeah. Why are we bad? I mean, I think it is interesting thinking about like there in both of these situations, there's like a component of complexity, and then there is a component of like considerably extended timescales, right? I mean, there are apparently like other bad things about the Bradford pear, right? It grows really fast, but it doesn't have a particularly long lifespan, so you're likely then to have like a dead tree falling on your house or branches falling all over. But then in the case of these, you know, redwoods in the UK, you have this plant that is lives for thousands or hundreds, if not thousands of years, that is towering above your local fauna. Just, I mean, I do kind of now want to see in like another 100 years what like the forest canopy looks like throughout the UK, where you just have these like random giant trees towering above the rest of the local flora. But that idea of thinking far out and thinking within complexity, because like city planning in general, like if we wanted to take it outside of trees for a minute, city planning has to deal with both of those things, of the impact that small things can have on like a very complex ecosystem of a city. And that's a thing that we fundamentally have to do. Nature is not going to like take care of it for us. And so we have to both be oriented towards sort of human behavior and cascade effects and second and third order effects of like individual things, in addition to then also sort of like the randomness of human behavior and how things change over time, right? Like gridded cities are, you know, theoretically good for these reasons, but in reality they wind up being terrible for other reasons. Or, you know, designing the suburbs in a certain way where everyone gets a private street and a cul-de-sac is like wonderful for like maybe kids being able to go out and play, but there are like all of these maps in different places that have large suburbs where to get like a mile as the crow flies could take you 25 minutes because the roads are not connected, even though like I saw one where it was 25 minutes and if you just like went through two backyards, you could have got to that same location.
But instead it was a labyrinth.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this goes back to some of the good hearts overhang discussion we have about like changing targets and predicting whatever the future target might be. Some things I'm sure our cognitive biases don't help with, where we're like, oh, it's obviously good for the thing that we're trying to solve for, and therefore it's the right solution. And then, of course, didn't fully apply a broad risk model to assess like, but that one, the one kicker of like, if this tree is not sterile, if for some reason,
if nature finds a way,
if nature finds a way, then we are going to have a really huge conservation issue on our hands.
Yeah.
I mean, trees everywhere.
Well, like in cities too, right? Like fruiting trees, like we're like beautiful flowers and like, you know, many of them are fragrant, apparently not the Bradford pear. And then you're also in a city and it's like, oh, shoot, we have a rat infestation now as a result of all of the fruiting trees dumping all of this fruit on the ground. And in addition to putrid stenches when you have like a bunch of rotting fruit on the ground. And
I mean, we can give humans credit for being adaptable when we cannot inevitably predict all of these things that at some point you're like, well, there's fruit dropping. What can we do with the fruit dropping? Like, let's figure out some way to make use of this or do something different. Like, as I was imagining the redwoods towering above all the other trees, I was like, well, what might that do? Like, could there be something that comes of that? Like, maybe some of the unintended consequences could be a blessing in disguise if only you were creative.
Yeah. I mean, what it can be frustrating, I think, probably is like the reverse effect where we're not doing things that would actually have like really positive results for fear of a negative impact, because I think we're as bad at that, right? Like we're sort of talking about these things where we like did a thing with the best of intentions. Like, oh, look at, aren't these redwoods beautiful? I'm not thinking about the fact that it's going to grow to be like 400 feet tall or something like that. But the counter is like, what are the, there's a name for the sort of street design that they're starting to implement in, I think they might be called smart blocks, or they're basically like remove, because of how Barcelona is sort of gridded into those big squares, and they're like doing this sort of structuring within that grid to make a bunch of areas like non-car passable. And a lot of people, you know, in sort of car or super blocks, also called a superia. It's making like people ride bikes more, so they're getting healthier. It's creating like more play space for children, more parks, more like opportunity where you can be outside in highly like densely populated areas. So like older folks are interacting with younger folks more. It's like creating all of these second order effects. But like the big fear in situations like that is that you're eliminating accessibility for cars or for people to like get around and impacting mobility. But, you know, now I think Barcelona is like several years into this experiment and is seeing like all these positive impacts. And other places have proposed it. We saw it in New York City during the pandemic where they were like shutting down streets and, you know, like city streets or whatever. And all of a sudden, like community is like building up and flourishing around it. But then we're like, the pandemic's over, like shut it down. We don't need that anymore. Yeah. But it's sort of like the flip example of like a fear of like ruining a thing prevents you from doing a thing that would actually create a much greater impact. And so basically, I guess what we're getting to is like, we shouldn't be allowed to make any decisions. Like, I don't know. Or like, is there a better way to like get at these conditions where you're able to do the good things too? Or should we just like not be playing with these wide scale experiments without pilots? Maybe pilots
That's the key, I think, because the reason some of these other things didn't work is because the pilot lasted too long a time horizon, and now the trees are everywhere,
yeah,
right?
Like, yeah.
There wasn't a way to experiment and allow yourself to choose what trade-offs you are agreeing to, right? Instead, it's like if you're able to test something in a smaller scale, in a smaller time horizon, then you can know whether it's a good thing. The problem is it's like, it's working, decided, and then you're like, but...
Yeah, look at all these beautiful trees that grew so fast.
The one thing that you didn't really choose was the major trade-off of it's gonna take over the world.
Yeah,
I mean, it's what's interesting. Like, if we're hesitant in some other contexts to make a greater impact, there are other contexts where we have, or seemingly fearless, like with trees, like with biological control, when we introduce a species to go control another invasive species, and then that thing becomes the new invasive species. It's like, come on, man. Like, could you not have foreseen that this was going to happen?
Yeah.
And it's because it's that future prediction of like, and then five dominoes in, what might happen here?
Yeah, the flip side of this is like, obviously, we're talking about, in some of these instances, like, theoretically, like, more low-stakes discussions of, like, oh, man, there's going to be a bunch of Bradford pears in everybody's front lawn, and it's going to stink. Or, you know, it obviously gets bigger if it starts impacting entire ecosystems. But, you know, the problems that we need to fix will still also have these sort of second and third order effects. And like, when you need to be making rapid change, how do you orient around like a pilot process, right? Like the cities, you know, there's an epidemic of loneliness, right? Like, this is a thing that we keep hearing in all directions. Like, the data continues to point that way. These sort of super blocks in Barcelona are like a thing that is theoretically seemingly reducing loneliness, creating more community, like free space, giving people time outdoors, like better place for family and for children within cities, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like, the potential benefits are great. Like, to get them and pilot and then do another one and pilot and so on, like, if that's needed everywhere right now, like, it's almost like, where is the speed happening? Like, should, like, other major cities in theory should be like piloting those things simultaneously. But like, what invariably will happen is like, great, let Barcelona test it. They'll do some stuff. Maybe some other European cities will then see Barcelona's success and they'll do some stuff. And then after like what seems like way too long for us to be getting the message, then we'll start piloting in one city. You know, like the speed of the good things sometimes is just too slow.
It's so interesting too. I think this is something kind of surprising that also happens in organizations. At least certainly I've witnessed it at ours, where it seems that there can be more momentum around creating like top-down big initiatives that are decided like unilaterally for all people, when actually some of the best change starts by just one person trying something. And if it catches on, that's great.
Yeah.
And it's a perfect example of this idea of like, we need to be more afraid of irreversible commitments and less afraid of trying a thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I had a discussion like this earlier this week, and not, you know, about our organization, was like, I think we should do this thing. And someone else is like, well, is that like a consistent policy now? And I'm like, well, I was really just thinking about this thing, like, you know, and maybe in hindsight, like, my response would be like, maybe it should be a policy, but like, we don't know yet. Like, let's test it out and see if it works. And
right.
But confronted with that question of like, well, is this like a policy?
Is
and then we're
thing?
We're
right.
Like implementing that and doing all these things. I'm like, I don't know. And then I'm like going through, I'm like, well, like, would this happen? This, like, and it was sort of like the wrong set of questions potentially to ask, and should have been like, let's see. Yeah. Like,
well, and I think also when, you know, just culturally and today, it especially when things are very difficult, the problems are extremely acute. The pressure to make a sweeping big change, decision, so forth, is super high. It's like, let's do something about this right now. And it should be applied everywhere. And it's like, that, I mean, this is the question of our times about bureaucracy.
Yeah.
And its benefits of like, what if we just break everything? And it's like, maybe. And the conservative side of argumentation might be like, well, don't move so fast. And there's got to be some middle space of like, why don't we try it?
Yeah. I mean, to your point, right, that like sort of progressive, and not even speaking politically, every time you use the word conservative or progressive,
but the
progressive orientation to like fix things and change things for the better, and the conservative orientation of saying like, don't break this thing, it's pretty great, right? Or like, protect this thing. Like, there is the sort of like loosely held version, like the sort of difference between like authoritarian parenting and authoritative parenting, where it's like, tell you the rules, but like, you figure it out, right? Like the sort of French parenting style, I think, as it's sometimes called, where you're looking for equilibria, right? Like, I'm thinking about, as you said that, like what our company's sort of like return to office policy is, which is basically like, we're going to do stuff. We think it'd be good if you're here 2 or 3 days a week, but like, you're a grown up and you got to figure out stuff for yourself. And there'll be like resources and sort of like perks of like lunch and snacks and seeing other people. But like, this is not a mandate. Like, I don't want to have to like think you're, you know, many of us like think through all the second, like, is it okay if a plumber comes to my house? Then do I have to come into the work? Or like, what if I have a doctor's appointment? Like all of these, like, where you're just like let it find an equilibria. And like, what the result has been is it seems that more of our company is coming into the office than other places because it's been allowed to find sort of a natural equilibria instead of some sort of like mandated thing that, even if it's 10 degrees off, is like enough to piss people off.
It's candy bowl theory, right? The idea that if you have a candy bowl or a candy drawer in your house growing up and you know it's always there, that, and there aren't tons of strict rules or trauma or other things around candy and eating and whatever, that like, you might just have a treat whenever is a good time. And then it's not, and then otherwise, right, you just sort of settle on some healthy state in between.
Yeah.
And that's like, I'm sure there have been studies about this. This is me talking anecdotally for sure. But the idea, I think, still stands of like, how to run more things by just letting the chips fall as they may. It's not always easy to coordinate big things that influence a lot of people in that same fashion, right?
Yeah.
You can do things on a smaller microcosm in your own house, or maybe in your case, at your own company. But then all of a sudden it's like, oh, it's, I don't know if we can do everything else the same way.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting to think about, like, one of the reasons that like Dunbar's number gained popularity, right? Like that number of like 150 people is like the largest number of people that you can sort of feel connected to. And like a ton of research was put in by the person who founded Gore-Tex to like, then he structured his organization around that number, where like no office would ever be more than like 150 people or something to that effect. I'm sort of paraphrasing, but maybe like individual teams would only be that big. But it is interesting, like, even within the context of these pilots, right? Like, what's the 150 that you
exactly
can then pilot within a super block or whatever, right? Like 150 buildings, maybe, for the context of us. Like, I don't know what that is, but there is, or maybe like 150 is the equilibria for social relationships, but like, what is the equilibria for,
right,
pear
for
trees?
Other, exactly. Yeah. What is a still controlled experiment,
yeah,
right before it gets completely off the rails. This is a great question. I'm sure many of our urban planners and conservationists would be very interested to know, because this tree situation is a perfect example of it maybe going a little bit out of our hands.
It is, like, there is sort of this dynamic where, like, putting in a principle in something suddenly has these crazy, like, when Google at some point was designing its offices, it had some rule. I mean, this was years ago. I'm sure it's not the same. The same rule doesn't exist anymore. But there was like a set number of feet that a person's desk could be from a micro kitchen. Or maybe it was like walking, you know, like no more than 5 minutes walking or, you know, 1,000 feet or something from a micro kitchen. So you could get like snacks or drinks or whatever. And just by putting that like one rule in place, like, will have like radical impacts on the ways in which they design their office spaces, right? Like, so people weren't sitting as closely together because they had to like plop a micro kitchen in like all of these different places to make sure people could get snacks, you know?
Yeah, it takes me back to a book we've mentioned on the show before a long, long time ago, but it's called Emergence, and it was like largely talking about like one of the vignettes about like just the difference of introducing sidewalks in a city, like only one variable being changed here and all of its like wide-reaching impacts. Just again, then the scientific study of all of this, it's like change as few things as possible.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, I think like even in this pilot, right, like what if you put like sectional benches in more places in the city, like, and to see like if and how people are using them, right? Like, do you then see like more community on the sidewalk that you definitely don't see right now necessarily in New York City, unless you get one of those like city street types of places, which are more like parks.
I know that in New York City, my friend Rachel Metz, the DOT, has talked about, Department of Transportation in New York, has talked about like all the different traffic experiments that they roll out of trying to be like, there are so many ways to make this safer. Like, is this a stop sign situation or a traffic light situation? Is this actually about like widening the distance between the turn lane and adding like a row for parked cars and a bike lane so that it's like safer for pedestrians when a car is turning because there's more space for someone to put on the brakes? Like, it's interesting to see, back to the Dunbar's number thing too, like even within certain organizations or systems, like they might be able to find a better way to control some of these things because the subject of study is also a little bit easier to control.
Yeah. I mean, I've noticed like in New York, the experimentation as like a cyclist in the city for, you know, 15 years or however long I've lived here, I think 15, 16 years. Like, you've seen how it goes and certainly has felt like it's made it safer. Like, the flip side, I think, is like, or sort of like what is an actionable thing to do is be like, be open, not implementing something, right? Like, we've actually had discussions about like sort of as career progression happens, like, and not exclusive to you, but other people have asked me, like, do I have to do this thing now? If I get to this place, do I have to do this thing? And I'm like, I don't know, maybe there's a different way to do it that I'm not, like, I don't want to give an answer to those things because then I know I'm sort of like collapsing like a singular path, and like I don't like doing that because I expect there's a thing that I'm not thinking about. But like, how do you get that orientation towards experimentation in your actual action? Is it because there's a version of this where you don't commit to anything and that is not like progressive either, and then there's a version of this where you like constantly over commit or are like over decisive in sort of like really rigid ways? And so,
you know what it is? It's the genuine maybe, Joey. The genuine maybe of it both. Seriously, I'm open to the idea that this thing that we're testing could work and that you will want to stick with it. But I am also genuinely uncertain if this is going to pan out. And I cannot commit that this is the right thing because that's why we're testing.
Yeah.
Right? Like, there's no reason in testing if you've already made too many assumptions. And the point is you have to see and that you have to decide. Like, you're not validating something. You are actually trying to figure out, like, which way should it go?
Yeah.
Should we pursue this or should we not? And those could equally be possible.
Yeah. I mean, the genuine maybe. Well, it's also made me realize, like, the number of times that I think a thing will work or the other times where I'm like, I don't know. Like, even, like, the culture and learning budget that we have, like, I was pushing for a long time when we implemented, but I was like, I don't know. Like, by the time we got to the point of, like, giving people the budgets and everything else, I was like, I don't know if this, like, are people going to be moved by this? Is it just going to be, like, this weird thing that no one uses? And, like, people have done, like, the coolest, most random shit that it sounds awesome, like learning to play accordion or taking cooking classes or, you know, doing, like, different types of dance and whatever else. Like, even just, like, going to the opera or whatever. Like, the variance of the way that it gets used and that everyone uses it was like versus other things where I'm like, this is going to be great. Everyone's going to love it. It's perfect. And it's like, like just total like dud. And so, yeah, I can see in my own like behavior experiences, like how bad I'm in it. Well, Jessica, do you want to genuinely maybe wrap up this episode? Also, Emerson has been recently obsessed with Call Me Maybe by Carly Rae Jepsen. Include that in the wrap-up.
It all started with trees being where they weren't originally intended to be. And as we have learned from the Redwoods in the UK, the Bradfords across America, and all kinds of things from our workspaces and the animals that we try to introduce to different environments and to the ways we lay out our cities, there are so many places that could benefit from trying a thing out before we lock ourselves into something we deeply, deeply regret. And just so we could all probably use a little bit more of a dose of genuine maybe in our lives and figure out what is the right controlled way to experiment a little bit more.
Genuinely.
Maybe.
Critical Nonsense is a Sylvain production.
Brought to you by Stop for the exciting idea that's about to cross your street.
As always, we'd like to thank our executive producer and executive maybe horticulturalist, Jess Vander.
You're welcome. We'd also like to thank sound engineer and Department of Getting It Done, Alex Contell.
We'd like to thank our programming coordinator and vice president of Yup, Les Jacobs.
Thanks to our production crew and Candy Bowl, Sarah Gilbert and Nora Mestrich.
And as always, thanks, Len.
Thanks, Len.
Special thanks, Candy Bowls.
Honestly, I really am very grateful to my parents for understanding this construct. I have so much self-control in our house, and then Ryan chastises me being like, are you going to eat that? And I'm like, I don't know. When I get to it, he's like, it's tantalizing me. Like, you can't leave the tree out there. And I was like, I have the advantage of the candy bowl. It does not tempt me.
That may just be you and not the candy bowl.
Like,
maybe that's true.
This is where I derive my sense of superiority. Please do not take it.
Yeah, I was like, I feel like my family was probably pretty candy bowl oriented. Like, I was not policed on what I ate at all, and
it did not do anything.
Stuff my face with a devil dog.
To be clear, I am sure that the science has both corroborated and disproven everything that I have said on this subject. Like, different people have different tolerances.
Yeah. Emerson is, we're like not really intense about what she eats or anything like that. And yesterday she's like, I had two candies today. Can I have it? And so I handed her the two pieces of candy and she's like, okay. And she did eeny, meeny, miny, mo of which one she could have and gave the other one to me. And I was like, I was expecting, I didn't say it, but I was like,
both, but
I was expecting you were going to eat both. It was like not big you know, it's not like a king size candy bar. It's like a Tootsie Roll and a Twizzler fun pack.
Yeah.
And then after she came back and she's like, so I was wondering if maybe, and I just like handed her the candy. Yeah, I was like, yeah, you're good.
Yeah. You want to also encourage either asking for what you want or a negotiation. And in this instance, she asked and she did receive.
Yeah. She did receive. Well, we did it.
We did it.
Thanks to you.
And you. Thanks for your treats.
Adieu, adieu, adieu. Bye. I love you. Mean it.
See ya.
Tree time bombs?
Tree time bombs? About tree time bombs?